This is Resonance 104.4 FM. My name's Jack Thurston, and you're listening to The Bike Show. This week, we're going to be talking with David Herlihy, who's author of a recently published and fantastic history of the bicycle. But before we go over to him in Massachusetts, there's some brilliant news. About half a year after it was closed down and everybody was locked out, the London Velodrome at Herne Hill has been reopened thanks to a new 3-year deal between the landlords, Dulwich Estate, and British Cycling. It was back in May that we featured an interview with Graham Geddes of the Herne Hill Velodrome Trust, and it's thanks to him and his colleagues that the track has been reopened. The track's been going since 1892, so it's almost as old as the bicycle itself. It's a brilliant place to go down and try out track racing for the first time if you've never ridden a track bike or ridden on a track. They have public open sessions on Saturday mornings and complete novice sessions from 9 until 10 o'clock in the morning. All the details are on the website. Just type in Herne Hill, Google it, and the Velodrome will come up. Now, I'm going to see if I can bring in David. David, can you hear us? David,
yes.
Can you hear us, David?
Yes.
David, fantastic. We finally made it. We made the link between London and Massachusetts. Is that where you are?
Yes, I am.
Brilliant. Well, thanks for coming on the show. And I must say that in all the brilliant writing that there is about cycling, and from every possible angle, the angle that I think has been missing for a long time has been a really good history, and you've filled that. How long did it take for you to write the book, and how did you get involved in writing a history of the bicycle in the first place?
Well, I'd have to say it took over 10 years. I was sort of drawn into it over time. I started out with, I was writing for Bicycle Magazine in the States, and they got me kind of digging into derailleur history in France, and then I started to learn that there was a lot more bike history than that. You know, going back to the 1860s, I learned that the fellow got the original patent, Pierre Lallemand, was buried in my hometown. I had no idea. I'd never heard of that before, so that got me interested in that period. And then I just kind of figured I needed to fill out the whole story, and it focused a lot on the 19th century. And then as I was writing the book, I dug also into the 20th century, which I think is, you know, quite an interesting story in its own right. So, yeah, and as far as, you know, where I went, it varied from a lot of libraries and archives in the U.S. and in Europe, principally. Also tracked down some descendants of key figures. So it was a lot of work, I got to say.
And when was the bicycle invented? I mean, what were the first things that you would class as a bicycle?
Right. Well, what I do is I kind of place the whole thing as a quest for a human-powered vehicle, because I think that's really the context. That worked. I mean, the traditional approach is to kind of look at a linear development of two-wheelers, so you have that kick-propelled machine around 1819, and then supposedly the next step would be to slap on pedals and so forth, but in fact that's not a very accurate model, because for one thing there's about a half-century separation between those two types of two-wheelers, the pedalless versus the pedal-powered one, and they're also very different concepts. So I really try to step back and say, no, what this is really about is a quest for some kind of practical human-powered vehicle, which really goes back centuries.
I mean, so this is the idea of replacing the horse.
Exactly. It's the search for a mechanical horse. And, you know, the first variety of, you know, what we might call an ancestor to the bicycle, the two-wheeler, without pedals, the kick-propelled machine, was an interesting development and, you know, caused quite a bit of excitement. It's fair to say it was the first type of human-powered vehicle that generated any kind of real excitement, however brief. But there again, I don't think we should step away from that context of the human-powered vehicle, because after that first variation of two-wheeler is abandoned, basically, the inventors revert back to the idea of three- and four-wheelers with mechanical drives. And you've got quite a few decades there of pretty much frustration before this, what I would call the original bicycle the pedal-powered machine bursts onto the scene in Paris, and it's really quite a surprise.
And so when is that?
That's a... it's basically noticed in the year 1867. I mean, that's when the first pioneer company, Michaud, is in action. There were several years of development preceding that that was kind of beyond the public notice, shall we say. In fact, it's sort of an interesting question about who really triggered that development, because you had a Parisian mechanic by the name Pierre Lallemand, the fellow that I discovered early on in my research, who left Paris in 1865 before there's any trace of bicycles on the market. And then, lo and behold, 2 years later, you have this Michaud machine that's essentially very similar to what Lallemand patents over in the United States in the year 1866. So it's sort of a controversy that I address in the book as to who really kind of had that that kernel.
I mean, basically, what it was in the middle of the 19th century, whoever it was who invented it, I mean, what was the reaction? How were these things received by the public at large?
Well, I think, you know, there was a great deal of excitement, really, because, as I say, that in my book, I go into some length to kind of show the frustration. I'm sure you've heard of Kirkpatrick Macmillan, you know, the Scottish blacksmith who supposedly built a rear-drive bicycle in the 1840s. And I look at that, and I really conclude that there's not much evidence to really support that. And the truth is that those decades were ones that, you know, there was a great deal of technological progress going on all over the place with steam engines and, you know, network of locomotives and steamships and so forth, and telegraphs and whatnot, but as far as the human-powered vehicle was concerned, the mechanical horse, it was a great deal of frustration with a lot of people concluding that it was a wild goose chase. So when these first pedal-powered machines, two-wheelers, appear on the market in Paris in 1867, it really is quite, it generates an enormous amount of excitement, because there's a sense that finally, wow, you know, here's a breakthrough, and maybe this can be done after all, because the two-wheeler, you know, obviously has some advantages. It's compact. its prime advantage, I suppose, is that it is compact. But still, in the context of the kick-propelled machine, it was considered a dead end. But in this new context, where you could propel it without striking the ground, suddenly that seemed something worth exploring. So
we are on radio, so we've got to have to create an image of these things. I mean, they are two equal-sized wheels. This isn't the penny farthings we're talking
about. That's right. Exactly right. And people sometimes get confused because they think of the penny farthing often as the first bicycle, but actually it wasn't. They were solid iron. They weighed about 80 pounds, so they have wooden carriage wheels. I mean, it's very much... it's, you know, impossibly heavy by any modern standard.
And the basic difference is that you pedal them by moving the front wheel with pedals that are just connected to the hub of the front wheel.
That's
There's no
right,
chain.
Which is exactly the same system in a penny farthing or high wheeler. It's just that by the time, you know, in the early 1870s, when that design evolves in England primarily, there's a lot of material improvement that goes into it. So that was a solid iron bars for a frame. You get lightweight steel tubes. You get ball bearings and sprung saddles and all sorts of improvements. Solid rubber tires. So when you get to that point, the bicycle becomes a roadworthy machine. It can go over 100 miles in a day.
Well, clearly 1869 was a pretty pivotal year, and we're going to take a trip back to then, because there is a bit of music called the Velocipede Polka that was written by Josef Strauss. Apparently he was impressed by some kind of performing velocipede troupe somewhere on the continent, and he decided to write a polka about it. And we're going to give a little bit of a blast of that, but stay on the line, David, and we'll speak to you in a couple of minutes.
Sure. Thank you.
the sound of the Velocipede Polka, composed by Josef Strauss and recorded there by the Slovak State Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Christian Polak. Have you heard that one before, David?
I don't think I've heard it, but I think it's a great piece.
I don't know if it conjures up in any way what it's like to ride on a bike, or whether they just were calling it that to sell a few more copies.
It does reflect the excitement. I think you can sort of feel that. This really was a worldwide craze that spread in that year, 1869. In the U.S., something like 20,000 of these machines were built, and that was an enormous number considering that they really hadn't gotten mass production down yet. So it was kind of an exciting beginning, but the fact is that unfortunately this what's now known as a bone shaker, these early bikes, they couldn't really sustain that outpouring of interest for long. It took longer than the public really had patience for as far as turning it into something roadworthy. And then when it did assume that reasonably roadworthy form in the 1870s, it was no longer the popular machine that the original bicycle was intended to be. It was pretty much reserved to athletic young men. So there was kind of a sense of betrayal there, a sense that the bicycle, the high wheeler, the penny farthing, wasn't really living up to the concept of a people's nag, which had created so much excitement in that early period.
So what were some of the kind of social impacts of this machine that gave people increased mobility at a much lower price than they would have had before?
Well, I think, going back to the original bone shaker period in 1869, it was really more anticipation and excitement than actual. There was some impact on the road, but it was mostly negative, with quite a bit of accidents being reported. When you get to the high wheel era, when the ridership is pretty much restricted to athletic young men, there's a significant impact, but it's pretty much confined to that group of relatively well-to-do young men. There's touring clubs that are formed. There's, of course, racing. It's still pretty much a limited, although it was a very successful industry, especially in Britain. I would say its impact socially was fairly limited, but when you get to the 1890s, or rather, the late 1880s, you have kind of this curious sort of reversion back to a bone shaker profile. In other words, kind of an inviting low mount with two equal-sized wheels, the difference being that this time you've got a chain and a sprocket and a lot of improvements. That bicycle that sparked the great bicycle boom, that of course had enormous impact socially and industrially.
What about the impact on the status of women in society?
Well, that's when it really had an impact, because, in the high wheel era, there's very little impact. Women aren't riding these things, and there is sort of a sideline making tricycles for society women, but again, the numbers would be very limited. But when you get to the era, the early 1890s, and this great bicycle boom starts to develop, women are very much a driving force behind it, because after being sort of, it was evident that cycling offered some a lot of advantages in terms of sort of getting out in the countryside, good exercise, companionship, and so forth. And with this new style design that women could actually ride, they certainly, there were thousands of women who wanted to participate in that.
Although I noted in your book that the Women's Rescue League of Washington, D.C., claimed that cycling prevented women from having children, promoted immodest attire, and encouraged improper liaisons with the opposite sex. So it wasn't, all one-way traffic. People did think that the bicycle was a kind of seditious instrument. In the UK, there's a long history of kind of leftist organisations overlapping into cycling, kind of communist time trial groups. Is there much else of that?
Well, that's true. It was controversial, there's no doubt about it. There were certain reactionary forces did not like the idea that millions of women were taking to the road, you know, for the reasons that you mentioned. For one thing, cycling really did require some kind of concession in the way of dress. I mean, women couldn't wear the typical flowing Victorian garb and still manage to ride a bicycle. So although there were attempts to develop what were still considered acceptable costumes, you know, it was a force of for dress reform, and that didn't sit well with some people. And just the notion that women did have more mobility and that they could be kind of wandering around without chaperones, and that it disturbed some people. And then, you know, I think maybe as a pretext more than anything else, there were health issues raised. But by and large, the medical community at the time recognized that a moderate amount of cycling at least was a good thing. So I think the general feeling was that overall, at least during the bicycle boom, that the bicycle was a positive impact. Of course, when you get to the 20th century and the bicycle's out of fashion and it becomes more what it was supposed to be to begin with, the poor man's horse, then I think there are different attitudes about cycling. But at least in the 1890s, it was considered kind of generally just a powerful force, positive force.
And there was a kind of a second golden era, I think, that's detectable from your book, at least, in the 60s and 70s, with the perfection of the road bike and the golden era of the great stage races on the continent. Do you think that's true?
I think that's true, yeah. I mean, that certainly, you know, as far as, I would say, a lot of collectors would consider that era sort of the, you know, the classic lightweight road bike. You know, 10-speed derailleur and so forth. So very collectible, those types of, you know, the Eddie Merckx era.
And what do you think the future has to offer?
Well, that's a difficult question. I mean, there's some thought that maybe a totally revolutionary recumbent design might take over. I'm not totally convinced that will happen. I think that we might see a continuation, at least in the short run, of a trend towards, you know, more selection, more kind of high-tech materials out there, and good values. I mean, you can buy a bike today that's a very, you know, has excellent components without spending a fortune.
Well, David, thanks very much for joining us on the Bike Show. We could talk for hours, and maybe we'll have to get you back on again in the future, because there's a lot more.
Thanks for the music. That was great.
You've written a 470-page book, which we could talk about for a lot more. And I bet there was an awful lot of stuff that didn't even make it into the book.
Well, that's true. You've guessed it. I have quite an archive of cycle history, but certainly we could talk about it anytime.
Great. Well, thanks again for joining us.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you, Jack.
Bye-bye. Well, that was David Herlihy, who's author of The Definitive History of the Bicycle, published by Yale University Press. It's an amazing book, and it cost £20, which I thought was quite a lot. But having seen it, it's full of the most amazing illustrations, and it's really comprehensive. So well worth splashing out on. I guess as long as people have been riding bikes, or there have been bikes to ride, people have been trying to ride them as fast or as far as possible. And the Paris-Brest-Paris race, which is over 1,000 kilometres, one of the most spectacular races in the history of long-distance cycling. But in the UK for the past few years, there's been a ride that's been trying to emulate the Paris-Brest-Paris, and that's the London-Edinburgh-London. And this was run just a few weeks ago. In the studio is Kieran Yates. Kieran, you were at the start of the race. I mean, what's it all about?
Basically, it's a personal challenge for the people who are taking part. It's unlike a time trial where people have to go flat out as fast as they can. There's a minimum time limit and a maximum time limit in which people can finish the ride in. So it's not a race, and it's not touring either, because the minimum time limit ensures that people have to finish within a certain time. And it's very much a personal challenge for those people taking part. I spoke to Glenn Slater, who gives his account of the ride in this clip coming up.
It was wonderful. I did it just over 85 hours. I think it was like 20th finished. Yeah, for 57 years old, I think it was the oldest. But it was, the ride was tough. It was tougher than Paris-Brest-Paris, which is the granddaddy of them all in terms of the long-distance rides. But this was longer and it was more climbing.
For people who have never done this kind of riding before, how would you recommend it to them?
Well, I think if you can ride a 600K, then you can ride a 1200. It's more mental. Once you get above 400K, it's more mental than it's physical, because you've proven you can do it. And the question is, do you want to take that challenge to do it?
I've spoken to a few people, and they've talked about how the mental side of the ride is quite the biggest challenge, really.
Right.
They've also talked about sleep deprivation and the effects of that.
Well, I was on, I guess the pills are called no-dos. I mean, yesterday, for those last three stages, I was taking, the caffeine uppers, and then plus if you ride harder, you get more blood flowing. So if you want a good time, you have to, you got to go to sleep deprivation. I think the hardest thing with the sleep deprivation is riding at night. Sleep deprivation at daytime,
right,
it doesn't seem to really bite, but at nighttime, because then you drift off and it's dark, and if you're by yourself, I was having a hard time on Monday night. We went from Hovingham to, Lincoln. No, Hovingham to Thorn, and I was having a hard time. I was tired, and I didn't take any pills, because I wanted to sleep. And I didn't think of it. You only had 3 hours of sleep at the beginning, which was just hardly sleep. So I had a tough time, but I kept at it.
And were you pushing for a fast time?
I wanted a good time, not a fast time. We did... I did Paris-Brest-Paris in 2003 in 64 hours and 1 minute. So, and this was 85 and change, and more climbing, longer distance. It was okay.
And did you enjoy the route?
It was great. It was wonderful. I mean, I've lived in England before in the early 90s. I like the lanes. Right? There's no, in North America, you don't find the lanes like they are here.
The country lanes.
Oh, yeah. Yorkshire was beautiful, and Scotland, my dad's from Scotland, was gorgeous. It was good. You knew you were in Scotland. Just when I crossed the border, I don't know where the border was, but I could just tell I was in Scotland. Got a little more energy to ride harder. But it was a very, very good ride. Very good ride. People were friendly. The controls were good. We had great weather. Couldn't ask for more.
Simon, we're back in Lee Valley. It's Wednesday afternoon. Quite a few rides to finish now. A few more on the road who are due back in the next 14 hours or so. I'm very impressed sort of being here and seeing these people come in and come back by the distance they cover. I've done long distances myself, not as long as this, but people I speak to in London who hear that I commute 11 miles a day, they're astounded by it. So the idea of doing 1,400 kilometres, can you sell that to a wider public?
I certainly hope so. The extreme long distances that these randonneurs do aren't for everybody, but if you want a way of really challenging yourself and seeing what you can cope with, then this is very accessible for everybody. All you need is a bicycle. It doesn't have to be a special bicycle. You can build up to these distances. It's an incredibly healthy way of life, but if you want to push yourself to the limit within safe limits, it's not like climbing Everest, but you can see how far you can push yourself, and it's your own personal challenge.
2009 is the next time this will take place.
That's right.
Are there any other opportunities coming up in the near future where people can do long distance rides like this?
We hold this event every 4 years. In between our 4 years, in 2007, there's the classic Paris-Brest-Paris event. That's 1,200 kilometres.
Yeah.
We will also be holding 1,000-kilometre events,
right,
but usually we will. The vast majority of our events are 200-kilometre events. Within any one season, you'll be able to ride 3, 4, or even 600-kilometre events, so you can build up to those and see whether long-distance cycling is for you, and you can build up these challenges.
Yeah. A lot of people I've spoken to have said that they started off being 200-kilometre events, and they got bitten by the bug.
That's right. There is some sort of addictive quality about it. It gets the endorphins going, and people want to see what they...
Yeah. The general Ordex events, they're going on all year round.
That's right.
And how do people, if people want to get involved in doing Ordex rides or start doing Ordex rides, how do they find out about doing it?
The easiest way to look on our website, which is www.audax, that's audax.uk.net.
What motivates these people to cycle for 60 hours? Is that the fastest time? And what was the slowest time?
The fastest people did it, and the fastest person did it around about 60 hours. And the slowest riders would have completed it around about 110 hours. So it's very much a personal challenge. I spoke to a variety of people, a variety of ages, riding a variety of bikes. You don't need specialised equipment to do it. So it's people vary from veteran tourists to former road racers who were doing it, and they all said it was a personal challenge. It's a bit like some people go and climb Mount Everest, some people go and ride their bikes a very long way and as hard and as fast as they can.
And is it a race?
It's not a race. No, it's definitely not a race. I think, mind you, to finish it in the minimum time limit allowed, you would be racing flat out practically. I think you'd be hard pushed to do it faster than 60 hours or so.
Well, I'm not heading out on a 60-hour Audax tomorrow. Tomorrow I'm heading down into the Kent countryside. And next week on the bike show, we're going to be riding with Alex Stredwick of Sustrans. And Matthew Tempest is going to be in the studio sitting in for me, talking with Darren Johnson, who's a Green Party member of the London Assembly. And he's going to be quizzing him about cycling in our great capital city. This is the bike show. My name's Jack Thurston. Next up is the Clear Spot. Let's travel light. We'll leave our bodies behind. We won't need bodies. We'll be all in the mind. Let's travel light. Let's fly by night, side by side in silence we'll climb, and we'll keep climbing till the end of time. Let's fly by night.